When you're assembling an outdoor grill, do you follow the instructions completely, or do you reinterpret what they tell you to do? That probably explains why you wound up with extra parts and the bottom fell out when you dropped the rack of ribs on it. Well, sadly, the same has been done with what many consider to be the greatest foundational document in the history of the world. Of course, I'm talking about the U.S. Constitution, ratified in 1788. U.S. Constitution created a framework for our republic while still offering a method to maintain its effectiveness through the amendment process. Yet that's not good enough for a growing number of people. Some seek to, here's that word again, reinterpret the original intent, while others, including Congress even, choose to surrender their role and responsibilities that the Constitution gives specifically to them. With us now to discuss the importance and the value of the U.S. Constitution and the dangers being created via the way the document is being treated is research fellow with the Independent Institute and author of the upcoming book being released this week, The Independent Guide to the Constitution, William Watkins. How are you today, Bill?
Chris, it is great to be with you. Thank you.
Well, I'm happy this book is around because for the layperson and with an amazing amount of effectiveness, yet brevity, you have brought, I think, the clearest understanding of the importance of the U.S. Constitution. I do want to mention the Independent Institute website is independent.org, and there's a whole host of fantastic information that you can gain from the work that they do, and you will benefit from it. Believe me, you obviously saw a concern, a problem, define it as you will, that brought about your book. Talk about what you were seeing and why you felt the need to do this work.
Well, what really motivated me with this book is that unfortunately our Constitution is taking more of a backseat to our form of government and how our representatives, our justices on the Supreme Court, etc., pretty much do what they see is just in the best interest of a particular policy and don't care what the fundamental law says. And this is the people's fundamental law, and to disregard it like that, maybe some of the policies will be good, but that sure does open up the opportunity to harm individual liberty, to harm our corporate rights in our states by ignoring the limits set in our fundamental law.
When we say, and you said the word people, has we the people gone from we the people of the states and the many, has that gone from that to we the people who are chosen to be elected and are the minority, but we have the power?
That's a great question. People have to understand that our Constitution, our whole revolution, upended this idea that governors were the masters and the people were the servants. In our system, it's the other way around. The people are the principals or the masters, and those who serve in government are our servants or agents. That is a glory of the American Revolution and Articles of Confederation, the Constitution. But what it appears has happened over the years is our governors have exalted themselves again and forgotten who is really in charge.
This might be challenging to do verbally, but for you listening, try to envision that pie chart. That's when you're talking percentages, a certain color will be that segment of the pie, and then so on and so forth until the pie is filled out. So with that concept in mind, Bill, what would the pie chart be with the original intent of the Constitution, federal versus state, and what has it drifted into becoming in the present day?
Well, you know, Madison tells us in the Federalist Papers, and not just Madison, you know, multiple friends of the Constitution in the ratification debates say that the powers of the new federal government would operate only on external matters such as war, diplomacy, that type thing, of course, foreign commerce. Everything else, the states would be as independent nations governing themselves. You look at that pie chart today, there's no way you can see any limits on the federal government to just external matters. They govern everything from, you know, local poor relief to local schools. It's a system way out of whack.
And the reason backing up what Madison's intent was, along with other framers, obviously, If that wasn't their intent, why do we have the 10th Amendment then?
No, that's right. The anti-federalist and the state ratification conventions were a little concerned that some of the clauses in the Constitution could be misinterpreted or used to hurt the people and the states. And that 10th Amendment affirms that, hey, what is given, and that's it. Everything else is retained. That proves that the Federalists, as they made their ratification arguments, weren't really trying to establish a huge centralized government. They say in the 10th Amendment, no, we agree with you. We just want these extra powers, a little bit more effectiveness to do a few other things. But that's not turned out that way.
So William Watkins, who is a research fellow with the Independent Institute, author of the upcoming book coming out this week, The Independent Guide to the Constitution, independent.org is the website for the Independent Institute, and you are listening to Issues and Ideas. Makes sense to understand that part of the federal power is to make money because the government spends, it has to have income in order to stay out of debt. Nice theory. We've seen how that got blown to hell. But anyway, and let's bring this into the here and now to help people listening understand. We're all waiting to see what the U.S. Supreme Court decides on the Trump tariff policy. If you read the Constitution, I'm reading it and I'm thinking, why are we having this delay in even the discussion? It seems relatively clear who's got the tariff power. And most people, I think, are saying it's not where the tariff power is resting with right now.
Yeah, it's Article 1, Section 8 gives Congress the power to lay and collect duties, imposts, excises, to tax, essentially. One of the defects of the Articles of Confederation was that the Confederation Congress had to depend on requisitions from the states, essentially saying, pretty please, states, we need X amount of money to pay our debts and fund the government. Would you send it on? And many of them didn't, some for good reasons. You know, in the wake of the Revolutionary War, economies were a wreck. Others maybe for not so good reasons. But we have this funding ability in Congress in the Constitution of 1787. The president, you look in Article 2, there's no taxing authority. He doesn't have the power to do that. I get the policy arguments that we should have a high tariff system to try to bring manufacturing back. That might be a good policy argument, but constitutionally, that's a call for Congress, not the executive.
So it'll be very interesting to see what the Supreme Court comes up with. I've heard through various sources around about the third week of February is when they're planning to come out with that ruling, so we'll see if that timetable holds true. Another topic of conversation, and this is a point of debate, too, between the Fifth and the 14th Amendment, the idea of due process. Is due process, by according to the original intent of the Constitution, available to all whose feet are on U.S. soil, whether or not they're a citizen or not?
Right. Well, the whole idea of due process is essentially that you have a right not to be deprived of life, liberty, or property absent proceeding in court by the law of the land, that you should get that process which is due. Obviously, part of that is Congress can set what by statute what processes are due, whether you're an alien, whether you're citizen, etc. There. So that is partly a congressional function in our immigration and nationality statutes, but also with the 14th Amendment, you know, we have nationalized citizenship established. We also have references to persons, but there's no problem give everyone having due process by the law of the land. Just let Congress pass intelligible statutes dealing with alien friends and alien enemies and what procedures should be followed in removing or granting citizenship, etc.
Because I bring that point up because I've heard people say or claim to state that the 14th Amendment reduces the level of due process established by the Fifth Amendment.
No. The 14th Amendment had a very narrow purpose, which was to ensure that the newly freed slaves, the freedmen, were entitled to the same rights and privileges as white citizens, if they could make contracts, if they could sue in court, etc. That was the 14th Amendment essentially constitutionalized the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And to blow it into anything else historically is an error.
As you well prove with your book, The Independent Guide to the Constitution, there's plenty of written evidence from the framers themselves, notes, communication letters, and a whole host of factual information to base an understanding of original intent on. Why has the reinterpretation, or as you described, there's basically three interpretive traditions: the early strict construction, originalism, the 20th century modern originalism, and the worst of all, in my mind, the living, breathing Constitution idea. What fed the watering down of the adherence to the original intent?
Well, I think you have, in the 1980s and 90s and going forward, I love the Federalist Society, good group of scholars, but you get a group of alleged originalists who, to borrow an example, an apocryphal example, but it was alleged that medieval scholastics would argue about how many angels could dance on the head of a pin, and this employed a lot of their time rather than other sounder pursuits. Same thing with originalism. Rather than just sticking to the good old originalism, the Jeffersonian strict construction that Madison, St. George Tucker, Jefferson, John Randolph, Nathaniel Macon used and argued for, I guess it's a publish or perish type world in academia, so we have all these new theories come up that, no, we can't just look at intent. We need to just look at the text and the original public meaning, divorced from the promises of the Federalists, and this, that, and the other. And so they divorce themselves from original intent, and then you look at what they're trying to peddle as original intent, and it's really just enlarging the powers of the federal government. Kind of the same result you're going to have with living constitutionalism, which is just, hey, the Constitution's a living document. It can be updated as needed via interpretation by the courts, and we need that since we're not in horse and buggy days.
Or the age old saying, I know how it reads, but here's what it means. Well, it means how it reads, because when you look at the original intent, it's a totally clear picture, and Bill demonstrates that with the Independent Guide to the Constitution. You can go cover to cover and become your own very own constitutional scholar, but also if a specific issue arises, your curiosity takes you to a certain point, you can go right to that article, that section, that clause, see the original intent, how we've drifted away, and a way to get back to the much-needed original intent, and it's all very easy to absorb. Bill doesn't talk over your head. He brings you into the history, which is always a fun thing to do and always a great foundation to stand on to understand exactly what the original intent was. Those are the key words. You can find out more about the Independent Institute, which Bill is a research fellow with, at independent.org. Coming out this week, The Independent Guide to the Constitution. Bill Watkins, thank you so much for helping us remember the value, the importance of this document, and our duty to adhere to that original intent. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.